Hello and welcome to the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, the Liberty's current affairs podcast focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, the host of the Majlis podcast and Radio Free Europe, the Liberty's media manager here in Washington, D.C. In recent months, a number of sitting and former officials in Uzbekistan are persecuted and some are put in jail for treason and espionage charges allegedly spying for Russia. The latest name on the list is Rafiq Saifulin, who was the director of the military think tank. Earlier, Vladimir Kolashin was sent to jail, as well as Kadir Yusupov. The court hearings are conducted behind the closed doors, so we really don't know much what is going on there, and Uzbek authorities are not forthcoming. But there are some striking aspects. For example, if not all, most of those people are accused of spying for Russia. Those people come from mostly military background and are convicted under the Article 157. So how to make sense of these rather interesting developments? To bring some clarity, I'm joined by family members of two detainees, Elena Kuburskaya, daughter of Vladimir Kolashin, Babur Yusupov, son of Kadir Yusupov, along with Steve Severlu, human rights lawyer, focusing on Central Asia, journalist Alisher Siddiq, the director of RFL's Uzbek service Ozotlik, and Bruce Panier, the editor of RFL's Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us today. So let's start with two of you, Babur and Elena. Babur, tell us about the current status of your dad. Where is he and how is he doing? And we know he has some health problems, correct?
Yes, indeed. The last time we spoke to our father was a couple of weeks ago. He is now in a prison in Navoi during his, I think today is 551 days that since he was taken away from us. And throughout this time, we were allowed two phone calls. One of them was last week, and one extended meeting with him in prison.
Very briefly, your father was diplomat in London before he was taken, right?
He was ambassador to Austria, or charge d'affaires, and permanent representative to the OEC from Uzbekistan. So my father actually retired 10 years ago, and in December 2018, he was arrested by the State Security Service. A lot of people have heard this story, but essentially, imagine being detained by the State Security Service of your country. You're put in prison in a cell. Mm-hmm. You're kept isolated, incommunicado for the first 4 to 5 months. You're told you're a spy, you need to confess, you can't call your family, you can't see your lawyer, and all you have is daily interrogations by men in masks. And add to that torture and denial of medication. And this is essentially what my father went through. Like most people who are detained under this article in Uzbekistan probably go through that too.
Okay, thank you, Babur. I mean, colleagues, also feel free to pose any question to Babur or Elena, and don't hesitate if you have any clarification points to add into the discussion. Of course, we have limited time scope, but within this time frame, let's try to get to the bottom of this very kind of strange development. For now, I'm kind of leaving big picture questions for later. So any points about these individuals, any needy and greedy details about these individuals, please feel welcome to talk about them and also ask any question to Elena and Babur. Thank you very much for that, Babur. So also let's get Elena your point in this. So what about your father, Vladimir Kolashin? How is he coping with the situation? Where is he these days?
To tell you the truth, we have no idea because nobody told us anything. And as you know, it was a quarantine in Uzbekistan. People couldn't go anywhere. My mother is there. Our lawyer is there. They were at home starting March. The trial finished right exact before the quarantine. So it finished on March 7. And since then, we didn't get any news from our father. My mother couldn't go there to the jail. We know that he is in Tashkent still, but we didn't know it until 2 weeks ago over the quarantine. And she was able to go there trying to give him food and medicine. They took medicine, not everything. They didn't take vitamins. They took medicine. They denied the food. And she is going to go there again tomorrow. Because they have from 15 to 17, you can bring food and medicine. So we'll see where he is. His health condition is very bad. He is 69 years old. So he has heart problems. He has asthma. In this situation, it's very difficult because with coronavirus, asthmatic people, they are first in the line. And at this age and this health condition, we are very worrying and we don't know how he is. Nobody tells us about his health condition and we don't know what to do.
And he was also charged for spying to Russia.
Yes,
what was that?
We don't know for which country. We didn't get the report or something. It was said that he is charged with high treason, giving documents to different country. They didn't say which country, so we don't know. Was it Russia? Was it America? You know, we have family in Russia. I live in America. I live in the United States. So we don't know. They didn't give us explanation. They didn't give evidence. It was fabricated trial, and I think it was very unfair and not professional.
Elena, what do you mean when you say the trial was very unfair? I mean, just walk us through a little bit the trial process. How did it go?
My father, he was a civil journalist. He was a journalist for 30 years. He worked for military newspaper, Vatan Pravar, which is Patriot, and he was a civil journalist. He didn't have any access to any secret information. He didn't work with Ministry of Defense or something. He was a regular person. So whatever happened, it was a shock to us because we never expected something like that to happen to a regular person in 21st century. When they just came, took him without any explanation, and he disappeared. So on July 2nd, he disappeared. We found him after 10 days, and they said that he is guilty of treason. So he was tortured, and they made him sign documents. The torture was horrible. You know, they were saying that they're going to rape his wife and kill her.
Why they would say something like that? I mean,
They want them to sign the documents, and he did sign it in the beginning. What? He didn't have a good lawyer.
What were those documents about, Elena?
We don't know. We know that they made him sign documents, whatever they gave him. And they say he agreed that he was giving information to other government. We don't know which one. It was closed trial. We didn't have access there. We hired a good lawyer, Alan Pashkovsky, in August. And he went to prison to my father, and my father denied him. They were pushing him not to take Mr. Pashkovsky because they know that he is good and he is not going to keep silent and he is going to go to human rights organizations. So they were trying not to involve him in the trial. Mm. So he started to work with my father in February. And, you know, my father, he's a journalist. Yeah. He has huge archive at home, huge. Mm. He kept all articles. He had so many newspapers signed, you know. He kept all the information at home. Our home was like big library of all newspapers and magazines.
Right.
So they took it all. They were taking the information with, you know, trucks from our apartment. So it was a huge amount of documents. Alan, Mr. Pashkovsky, our lawyer, started to work with my father in the beginning of February. They started the trial on
Alina, your voice is cutting off.
I'm sorry.
So we will get back to some of the details that you were talking about. Let me also get, Babur, your point on this. I mean, how your sort of the experience has been so far in terms of these legal process or any process after your father was detained.
Yes, we went through a similar ordeal as Elena mentioned. She talked about the trial. Now, let me tell you our experience of the trial. It's a secret trial. That means no family members or any observers such as media or human rights organizations are allowed in. Throughout the process, we had no real cross-examination of witnesses. There was no evidence presented, and any complaints and motions that the defense raised as to, you know, torture and allegations of mistreatment, the judge essentially declined and said that there's no objective evidence to verify those claims. So that's pretty much the environment in which this process takes place. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to find accountability. Mm-hmm. There are no minutes of proceedings. And even those parts of the trial that might be arguably considered non-sensitive, such as, for instance, in the case of my father, his psychiatrist gave a statement, those are held secret too.
Mm-hmm.
And just to clarify, our lawyer is also Alan Pashkovsky. He's going to be mentioned quite a few times in today, I guess. And he's been doing an incredible job trying to push, sort of protect his client's interests.
Mm.
use existing legislation, but to no avail.
Steve, formerly you as a Human Rights Watch, as Central Asia researcher, on and off in Uzbekistan, and mostly watching these cases, if not, you know, in the court, outside of the court, the stories that we are hearing from both Elena and Babur, how familiar are they when looking to trial process in Uzbekistan?
Yeah, as they courageously detailed just now, these cases are marked by very credible allegations of torture, by the most serious due process violations. And as we've seen, these cases are happening under Mirziyoyev's Uzbekistan, supposedly a new Uzbekistan. These cases really point to the persistent practice or the persistent existence of this parallel criminal justice system where the security services have virtually absolute power to arrest, detain, in the least credible way possible, accuse various citizens. And, you know, we've talked about here a journalist, a former diplomat, but in other cases we know of several soldiers, Alisher Achildiyev, who's been in prison since 2006, Ravshan Kasimov, another soldier in prison since 2009, both who had spent time, or Kasimov had spent time in the U.S. and therefore came under scrutiny. We know of a researcher also now in prison, Akram Malikov,
and
the Academy of Sciences.
Said Aziz Yusupov is another person, I guess.
He's connected to the world of journalism. We saw, of course, the well-known case of a scholar on Turkey, accused of spying for Turkey, Andrei Kubatin, whose case garnered a lot of attention in the academic world last year and was happily released in 2019 and rehabilitated. But all these cases come down to what I would say is the power of the security services to, in a very unaccountable way, arrest and detain, which I would call this spy mania, which is something that was very well known and associated in Islam Karimov's Uzbekistan, but unfortunately continues to this day and hasn't been addressed. As you said, Article 157 is vague, it's broad, it doesn't really comport with international standards, and most importantly, the way it's being practiced and applied with torture really violates all the statements of reform that we've heard, including President Mirziyoyev's anti-torture decree, which he signed a few years ago, in which he stated that it was a priority to end torture in Uzbekistan. These cases all seem to have those elements in common.
Right, right. Also, one name still is missing from all this discussion is the think tank chief, Rafik Saifulin. With that, Bruce, let me bring you in here. I guess you had some memory of him. So tell us about him. And also, were you surprised when you heard that he was taken in?
Oh, first of all, I have we met at a conference more than 20 years ago in Washington, D.C. But he was willing to talk to me. You know, for Uzbek-U.S. relations, you know, 1998, they were actually pretty good. Uzbekistan wanted to be friends with the United States. I mean, he struck me as a classic Soviet person. You know, that was the first thing I thought about him was that, you know, I'd been to the Soviet Union and he still had that whole kind of mentality. But I, you know, because I had met him then, I kept seeing his name pop up over the years. You know, I mean, he was obviously very influential in the Karimov government. You know, he was worried about me being a spy. So I thought it was kind of ironic when I heard that he had been picked up for, you know, he had been detained on spying charges. But he seemed to be a pretty prominent figure. You know, and when I saw that he was accused of spying, assumed, I guess, for Russia, you know, I was kind of surprised. And my first thought was this really it? Or did he cross somebody? You know, because we know how politics works in this place. You know, we've heard Elena talk about the threats they made to her father. Well, these kind of things happen a lot where they say, you know, if you don't do what I want or give me something that I want, I'm going to say that you are, you know, and fill in the blank, spy, homosexual, something like that, you know, to tarnish your image. You know, maybe he was, I don't know, but he had certainly been around for a long, long time. It's kind of how all of a sudden after, you know, he was there practically from the start. So it's almost 30 years, you know, that he'd been up there, and how all of a sudden they found out now that he was spying for Russia. I have no idea. And I, you know, I just have to wonder, maybe he crossed somebody he shouldn't have. And this was the punishment.
That's very interesting. I will get Elena and Babur your points on the same question in a minute. But before that, Alisha, when you think of these latest trials and convictions, and as Steve mentioned, other than these three names, we can think of Akram Malikov, Said Aziz Yusupov, Alisher Achildiyev, also someone that Steve has mentioned. So do you recall any other name that is missing out from this discussion? I mean, what I'm trying to understand is what's the size and scope of this? What Steve said again, spymania, trials.
I think this is Babur. Yeah. I think there was also Sanjar Ismailov, who was another military guy. And they, if I'm not mistaken,
Babur, they studied together. Babur, let me bring in Alisher here. He closely looks into these developments.
Yeah, we have reported about a couple of dozens of cases, you know, since the past 10 years, like since 2010 at least. And there are various types of spies, you know, spies for Moscow, spies for US. I'm keeping it like, you know, ironic, yeah, spies. Mm. So then don't take it literally. Mm. And even one spy for Tajikistan is a lady called Alena Kim. She was sentenced to 10 years in 2017. And she was working in Interior Ministry and, you know, a very low profile job there. And she went to Tajikistan once and came back, and then after she left already Interior Ministry, then she was arrested and put in jail for spying. You know, of course, the case of Kayum Ortiqov, it's a prominent case, spying for Britain, so-called spying for Britain. Again, now he resides in U.S. His story of torture is beyond any imagination, right? Mm. I mean, just one example, his testicles were literally burned. So that's like absolutely amazing. And the level of torture that he experienced, and he was just a guard at the British embassy. Then if you remember, there was Yuri Karipanov in 2010. He was sentenced to 16 years, again, spying for Russia. Alexander Makeyev, he was released in 2017, but he was put in jail in 2010 for 15 years. Again, the same claims kept coming about tortures, and he was also retired. Yeah, there's one other point about all this, majority of these people, they're all retired. Then the case of Erkin Musayev, probably mentioned here. So he was another former official at the Ministry of Defense, and he was released in 2017 also. Also was given 15 years, also tortured, and was kind of accused of spying for United States. Then, of course, Khayyum Yusupov, everybody knows this case. Absolutely crazy stuff, you know, Vladimir Kaloshin, Akbar Yarbabayev, Rafik Saifulin, and many others, you know, in this past trial.
Elena, I was wondering about this when Bruce was talking about crossing someone. And did you guys, you and your family members, kind of felt that something is coming on your way? I mean, what are the sort of developments that led to the actual detention of your father? Was there any indication that something is bad happening?
No, never. You know, my father, he is a regular journalist. He is writing stuff about what's happening around there, and he knows what to write, what not to write. He will never write something against government or something. He had bad experience, actually. You know, in 2007, he was working for Voice of Uzbekistan, the newspaper, and they wrote an article when people from the village, Nuhalya, they sent a letter saying that they don't have water, even though everything's supposed to work, and they have to go and pick water from the river. And after that, they all journalists were hired. It was an investigation with secret services, and they made them write articles saying that it was a lie, and journalists were trying to show government from a bad side. And can you imagine, after a couple of days everything was fixed there, so people got what they needed, but journalists were punished very bad. So I think starting that time in 2007, they put him on the list, and they kept him here. So when they needed someone to become a spy, they got him, he was on the list. So my father, he's a very nice, very kind person, and he is a simple person. He didn't have ambitions or something. He just wanted to live his life quietly, you know, happily, because he is old enough, you know, people want to live happy life. What happened, it was, we weren't there. My mom was with my sister in Moscow. I was here. The neighbors told us that they took him away. Nobody let him call and tell it. So it was horrible. It was like in 1937, when Stalin, he was taking people and just put them in jail, kill them. That's it. This is, you know, in 69, this is death sentence, 12 years for nothing. They didn't prove anything. It's a death sentence for a person who has very bad health condition.
69 years old, right. Babur, what was the evolution of your father's detention? I guess he was already retired, and he was, what I'm guessing is, like, he was not in a position to try to cross anyone. I mean, I guess my question is, what is your side of the story, why he's detained?
So, yes, my father retired in 2009 from the civil service. And as Alisher mentioned earlier, a lot of these people, suspects, are retired. The actual prosecution, and this is according to the spokesperson of the Prosecutor General of Uzbekistan, they state that they believe that he started spying in 2015 only. So it is not a historical crime. It is sort of the recent 4 or 5 years. Now, in my view, it's very difficult to see what sort of access my retired father, with all due respect to his previous positions, could have had 6 or 7 years after leaving the government.
That understood. Then what do you think, why he was the target?
Well, in our case, we have a further complication because my father suffered from mental health issues, as you mentioned earlier. He's how this whole thing came about was that he attempted a suicide in Tashkent. So he jumped under a metro train. And to understand this, it took us a while to come to terms with this. But we later discovered that it was his second suicide attempt. Previously, he tried to take his life about 2 or 3 years after retiring from the government. So it is this history of mental health issues. And when he was in this sort of psychotic state, luckily he survived, as I said, the metro train, it rolled over him. But when he was in a psychotic state, he told the police who arrived, obviously that was a big deal, he jumped under a train during rush hour on Pushkin station on the Monday.
Yeah, those are very important details, Babur. What I was trying to understand is, I mean, the reason your father was arrested, was he posing a threat to someone? Did he try to cross someone? Why he is detained now after so many years, when you are saying that he had no access to any kind of sensitive information to be helpful to anyone? I mean, then why?
It's a good question. And we also... Sure, Steve, go ahead.
No, not to cut you off, Babur. I was just going to say that, you know, studying these cases for a really long time, and I think Alisher did a very good job laying out the span and the scope, it's a quite futile search for logic behind many of these allegations because they're quite simply absurd. And in the case of Kadir Yusupov, as Babur stated, the security services literally arrested a man out of his hospital bed as he hallucinated. So the allegations become farcical and absurd. And, you know, one thing that I've noted in some of these cases, going again back to prior to Andijan and after Andijan is when this really picked up in a major way, was this idea that sometimes the motivation of a security service division, department, or officer that was making these accusations was simply to prove to their superiors, and I think in some cases at that time to the president himself, that the SNB, now the SGB, was protecting Uzbekistan's borders, protecting the fatherland, the homeland, from outside threats. They were, in a way, I think this was something that Karimov cultivated very strongly, because he was, as we know, authoritarian rulers tend to be paranoid. Mm. And I think the security services capitalized off that paranoia. And it became, over time, I think, a pretty institutionalized practice to search for new enemies and to say, we still deserve to have this absolute power in the system because we are protecting you from terrorism, extremism, and other threats. And I think in many cases, it's about this particular bureaucracy wanting to retain its power.
Mm. So that is your analysis of the situation, Steve. But what the authorities explained to you? I mean, as part of your job, you were in Uzbekistan earlier as the representative of the Human Rights Watch. So when you push authorities, when you try to get answer to what is happening behind the doors, then how they would explain what is happening?
Well, no, that's a very good question. And I should say I'm still following these cases now in other capacities. But when I raised the case, for example, of Mr. Andrei Kubatin, who was a scholar, a very respected scholar of Turkey, of ancient civilizations, a linguist, it was very clear that he was a very serious person and he was working with a Turkish cultural organization. When I raised the case initially, I remember that the prosecutor general's office was extremely hostile. They said, he's a criminal, he's a spy, we caught him red-handed, we have all the evidence. But when you poke and prod in these meetings with officials, they don't really have the goods, they don't have the evidence. It's usually a very general narrative. And over over time, we saw in Kubatin's case, which gives me some hope for Babur and Yelena's relatives in jail, is the case completely fell apart. The court, after the persistence of family members, actually exonerated him completely, rehabilitated him completely, and even the State Department called attention to how Article 157 was flawed in so many cases and should be reexamined. So I believe that often the officials that are charged with speaking about these cases are not the ones arresting them, and often don't know how to defend them. And that's quite simply, if you don't know how to defend an accusation, that's why you close a trial, that's why you create all these obstacles, and you use fear and intimidation instead of credible evidence.
Then why to use Russia as a scapegoat is kind of a very interesting question. Maybe we'll get to that a little bit later. Now, the question is, the authorities doesn't say much, and the hearings are kind of conducted behind the closed doors. What's our educated guess on where the authorities going with this, and what does the timing tell us? Let's continue the discussion talking about these and many other questions very shortly. First, let me recap the debate that today on the Majlis podcast. I'm joined by Yelena Kuburskaya, daughter of Vladimir Kalushin, and Babur Yusupov, son of Kadir Yusupov. Both of them are currently behind the doors in Uzbekistan. Also joining Babur and Yelena is Steve Severlu, who's the human rights lawyer specializing in Central Asia. Journalist is Alisher Siddiq, who's the director of Radio Free European Liberties Uzbek Service, Ozotlik, and Bruce Panier, the editor of Radio Free European Liberties Central Asia blog. Kishlok Owazi, I'm Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free European Liberties media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. So let me start with you, Bruce. So when you see these names, the way they are detained, the way they are treated once they are detained, how you read this? What's happening?
Well, I mean, I'm trying to figure out how they would, you know, if you're detained and you're as being a spy in the West, I suppose you don't have much access to people, but there's at least some information about what's going on. And let's face it, you know, like in the United States, for instance, people get picked up for being spies for like Israel or something, you know, people nominally allies of the United States. I've seen it before, you know, and but at least they're willing to admit that much. The problem with what happens when it's in Uzbekistan or really anywhere in Central Asia is that the authorities just clam up immediately. The only version of the story you get is their version of the story. And possibly some family members have visited them, or at least they can recount the history that led up to the time of the detention to try to show that this was pretty much absurd. But, you know, in Central Asia, like I said, again and again, once these people are locked up, they in effect disappear. Once in a while, they're, you know, like I said, family members visit and say they're still there. They're never allowed to present their side of the case at all or speak to anybody. They can't give any kind of statements, you know, so you're just left with, you know, like I said, basically the authorities' version of the story and what family members can tell you about what happened. And, you know, there's almost no way of any independent verification of any of this stuff, you know. And I thought it was interesting, Elena was mentioning they had sent her father a lawyer. This is like an old trick too, and you know, Steve and Ali Shear will know this all the time. Families find competent attorneys to defend their relatives that are jailed, and then all of a sudden the you know, the actual defendant or person who's been convicted doesn't want them, you know, so they can't even get adequate legal defense, although, you know, on the face of it, it looks like they simply rejected that attorney. So it's like method, and it repeats itself over and over again, to the point where it was never credible to begin with, but you can see that, you know, as this goes on and repeats itself again and again, that this is just the way that they approach the tactics that the authorities use. None of these people are ever exonerated, which is also just amazing. I've never seen a review of the case where they said maybe we made a mistake here or something, you know, but then of course we know, and as Ali Sherwood could tell you better than anyone, the presumption is that you're guilty if you've been detained, which is also works against anyone who is detained, and these are very serious charges. It's one thing to be detained for a traffic offense or something like that and presumed guilty, but when you're detained for spying and you go into the courtroom and you know that the judge thinks you're guilty, it's got to be psychologically horrifying for you to realize you just don't have any chance to get out of this.
Yeah. So, Alicia.
Yeah, one thing that to add
very quickly.
Real quick is just that in the cases of human rights defenders and journalists that have been released, as we know, we've celebrated that something like over 50 high-profile political prisoners since 2016 have been released in Uzbekistan, and maybe hundreds. We're not exactly sure how many religious prisoners. But one of the key elements to getting them free is that the U.S., the EU, and other international actors are willing to raise those cases. And I think the big problem for these families is that when you've got an allegation that your relative is a spy, that's when all of a sudden it's really difficult for foreign embassies in Tashkent to want to speak out about these cases, lest they reinforce the idea or the mythology that this person was working for those governments. And so it becomes really difficult to make progress.
Right. Alisha, just very much connected to what Bruce was saying, these hearings or these convictions are coming after each other recently. There's two cases that we are talking about. The recent one is Saifullin. It looks like they sort of connected to each other. Is it your feeling?
The old cases are connected to each other?
Yeah, some of the recent ones especially. Yeah. Why I say that, the spying for Russia, treason, kind of, it looks just one page from a book.
I mean, if Uzbek Security Service put me in jail and torture a little bit, they will find connection between me and you. Yeah, we work the same organization. We talk often in this Majlis podcast. So the connection is rather vague. Talking and being together, sitting and drinking together, this type of connection. I don't believe that there's a special criminal group that work together and contemplating against Uzbek regime, days and nights, working with Kremlin. So this is a little too dark. Kind of a scenario. It's for us, it's difficult to analyze and judge whether they were involved in some kind of information sharing, because we were simply not in the court, and we cannot be in the court because Uzbek law says you cannot be in the court, because Uzbek law defines this type of courts to be closed as a military tribunal. The logical analysis is breaking down because of that. So because we're missing a lot of kind of a pieces of this puzzle. But, looking from different angle, how other institutions work in Uzbekistan, how police or security services work in Uzbekistan, you can kind of speculate that there is a kind of unit, this intelligence unit in the National Security Service, and their job is to find spies. And every time they have to show that they are relevant. And this attempt to show relevance, they need to show time after time that they're doing some job. Here's your spy. The spy thing is, of course, as for Uzbek statehood, this might be even important from that point of view. We are the state, we have secrets, we have spies. So it gives that attribute of a full-fledged state where someone wants from you something.
Yeah, yeah? But we are kind of having questions about the credibility of all these saga. So why? What I'm saying is, if Uzbekistan is trying to make up this, then why to use Russia? It's a huge gamble.
Babur, our case is not Russia related, for what it's worth. We are actually being accused of Western. My father's accused of being a spy for the West.
Really. Russia, this crazy analysis that, the latest case with Saifullin shows the country's growing distance from Russia, this kind of analysis I've read. This is all kind of a very shallow, because you should know what's the relationship between Mirziyoyev and Putin today. There's a joke around that if Putin asks, Mirziyoyev could have told him everything he wanted, he needed to know. Yeah, so there's no need for middleman spies to tell directly to Moscow what's going on in Uzbekistan. Uzbekistan is a country that still up until now is run by thousands and thousands of secret services, agents, defense, police, and they also believe that they're sending strong signal to these people. Treason, all these things, how they are punished in Uzbekistan, that you should be careful. That's kind of keeping these people under threat,
being watched.
fear. So, you know, then you go back and look into the legislation. Yeah. So the legislation about secret information is such a vast legislation. It's totally, almost all of it is Soviet. The law on secret information was signed in 1993 by President Karimov. And, you know, everything is state secret. Statistics, you know, minor information, the amount of Uzbek soldiers. You know, recently Uzbekistan sort of removed some information from the secret. Nah. How do you say?
Decolonized the them?
Yeah. And that was, you will be amazed. What is this? The number of prisons in Uzbekistan is no longer a state secret. The number of detention interrogation centers is no longer a secret. How could it could have been that secret? Yeah. The number of inmates. Yeah. Die in prison is a state secret. So that recently was what was changed. But imagine how much is not changed. What type of information could have been communicated unknowingly, which is already a state secret. Yeah. Mm. So that's the bigger problem. And that's what makes these secret trials so easygoing. Mm. Yeah. Mm.
Bruce, talking of the person that you were earlier referring to, Saifullin, at least in his and a couple of other cases, they were accused of working for Russia. Did Vladimir Putin say anything? Did his interior minister say anything about these cases? What has been their reaction?
No, you know, I don't ever remember them. You know, unless it's a really big country like the United States or something, I don't think they ever comment on that. These accusations have come out of not just Uzbekistan, but other Central Asian countries in the past. And I do not remember Russia ever really commenting on that. Not the government. There have been cases where Russian people with dual citizenship have been locked up in Uzbekistan. And you did get perhaps local officials, but certainly like local media from where the person had family in Russia or something that would come and start mentioning this, but you don't get really official reaction for that. I'm sure they discuss it behind closed doors, or the Kremlin just dismisses it as not being worth their time to answer because it's untrue.
Mm-hmm. It's just a very kind of strange situation that we are trying to make sense of something that we really don't have enough information, the full picture of the story. So, I mean, is there any, and any of you, just feel free to jump in, any of you can have a educated guess on what might have triggered these investigations?
I think if I could chip in, this is Babur.
Yeah?
Many of my colleagues here mentioned the Soviet past. During the Soviet times, there was an infamous Article 58, Part 1, which introduced the formal the notion of enemy of the state and traitor during Stalin's times or even before him. Mm. And so I think this, the Article 157, is sort of the legacy of that is still present in Uzbekistan.
Yeah.
And of course, every country has the right to defend its secrets. But as many other speakers have mentioned, in the case of my father, when he was working in the private sector, after retirement, he helped a group of farmers from Uzbekistan travel and attend a farm expo in the US. And he worked with the USAID organization. Similarly, he worked with the Konrad Adenauer Foundation for Development. But any of those links could be the trigger. I mean, even the fact that I live in London, and often when I go back, I get questioned at the airport. Very valid questions. What do you do in the UK? But there's always this intrinsic thread that we can link you to something if we want to.
Okay.
And no. I think the issue here is, yes, this legislation exists, but there are lots of other things like accountability of the state security service, and also the question of torture, which has been very relevant, especially in the last few weeks, which is a separate discussion.
Those legislation always existed, Babur. What my question is, I mean, what does this timing tell us? Is there anything that we are missing out? I mean, who wants to take? Bruce, Alicia, Steve, just jump in. I mean, is there anything you have seen that might have triggered Uzbekistan to take these actions? I mean, those people were always there. They could always, you know, accuse someone in anything that they want to. I mean, what is this all about? I mean, it's just not only Babur's father. It's not only Elena's father. It's a couple of other cases that we have already mentioned that all kind of comes together. And what does this tell us, the timing?
I think, again, this is a persistent feature, not a bug. It's a feature, unfortunately, of a system that has persisted for a long time. And we've seen it goes in different directions. Sometimes Russia is used, sometimes Turkey, sometimes the U.S., especially after Andijan. I remember working with Kayum Artikov and hearing his torture. You know, these are some of the worst and the darkest, unfortunately, aspects of Uzbekistan. And I think the point is that this is an area where reforms have really really not touched yet, and we see it continuing. And you know, now the UN Committee Against Torture very recently listed the names that we've been speaking about here, calling for their release. There's been a lot of discussions about reform of the, or amendments to the criminal code of Uzbekistan, which I hope will lead to Article 157 being either abandoned completely or rewritten at least. And very importantly, again, the government has recently, they appointed the Deputy Prosecutor General, who we know well, Svetlana Artikova, to create a commission on torture, which would allow citizens to complain. We haven't gotten any clarity about whether or not human rights activists will be part of that process, but that is a commission, for example, that should re-examine these cases. And I think here we've listed several candidates for immediate and unconditional release. So I see, unfortunately, this is not a bug, and this is not, you know, something that's happened or been triggered recently. It's something that continues to happen. And there are, as Alisher said, dozens, maybe more, of people in prison. And now it's good news that the state is declassifying information about the number of prisoners, the number of prisons, and the nature of the charges of prisoners. Because once that is known, then some serious advocacy and research can be done to revisit these cases, as former U.S. official Alice Wells called for in September 2019.
Yourself, like Steve, you're like an interior ministry official. Of course, somewhere by mistake, you will tell someone the number of prisoners, right? I mean, just you don't know like whether that was secret at all.
Yeah, you know, these are very valid points, both Alisher and Steve. Bruce, did you have any thought about the timing of this thing?
You know, I mean, like I said, every few years they pick somebody up, it seems like, for this kind of thing. I think the best thing I can add here is because, you know, I was detained in Uzbekistan for being a spy 27 years ago. And I'll tell you what it was like. I was 4 hours in detention speaking with this captain about this. And we got to one part where I told him, you're accusing me of being a spy and I'm not a spy. And his answer was, if you were a spy, you would tell me that you weren't a spy. And I know most of you have seen me. I'm sorry, Elena and Babur, you haven't. But I said, look at me. I don't look like any. No one's going to mistake me for their cousin, right? There's no way that I blend in with this. And I'm working in villages. What am I spying on? How many apricots are growing on the trees? How many sheep are in the field? It didn't make any difference to him at all, you know? And that was 27 years ago.
And
it got better.
You, Bruce, the spy.
Bruce, you gave me another idea for my wild
imagination.
Speculation. They never catch real spies because catching a real spy has political implication. What Tahir mentioned, you know, why Russia is not mad about it, why Britain was not mad, and no one is mad. The United States is not mad because they never catch a real spies, and then they're not ready for this type of political backlash. Yeah, so that's why. But they need spies. They need to catch these spies. There's a unit, like a counterintelligence unit in National Security, State Security Service. 4 or 5 people. They need to work. They need to get salaries. They need to prove that they're working. So that's why they just catch these small fishes, and then everyone is happy. You know, everyone is fine with that.
Let me follow up on that, Alisher. You brought us really into an interesting question. Then, who are the apparent beneficiary out of these developments? I mean, maybe it's an institution. Maybe they are individuals. I mean, who kind of benefiting from all this discussion about spy game?
Yeah, you're asking me. Again.
Yeah.
Okay. So since we don't have a lot of information, we're just speculating how it could be. Yeah.
Yeah.
So as I said, you know, for the state to be important, you need to have these attributes. Yeah. This one of the attributes is someone is spying on you. Yeah. So that's where you can always sell that thing. Another thing is that really, when you have so many security service officers, agents, you need to from time to time send a signal. What are the implications for even talking to foreigners? Uzbekistan is not suffering a lot due to these spy things, you know, on the international stage. I don't think that it's often raised issue for Uzbekistan. They can always say, you know, we're defending our national security. We have the right to defend ourselves. So it's not some burning issue for them. You know, it's not that everyone who comes to Uzbekistan reminds Mirziyoyev about these cases. He can always refer to their own cases. Yeah. He will ask Putin, what would you do? You also put spies in prison. Trump cannot ask. No one can ask. Everybody is catching spies. That's like how...
This is Babur. I would just like to add that I think rather than being a one single beneficiary, I think there is this Kafkaesque machine that exists. And in we see it in other parts of this of the economy, for instance, where it's so top down, it's so quota and sort of goal driven. You need to get this number of things. And I'm not suggesting that they have quotas for finding spies, but very often you do need, it does appear that there needs to be this sort of accountability that for the last year we've done this volume of work. And I think as if you have the misfortune of getting stuck into this machine, it's very hard to prove that you are not what they say you are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we have to really conclude the discussion. I know, Steve, you want to say something? Yeah, please, very quickly.
No, I was just going to say that. I mean, I agree with the analysis Ali Sher and Babur just provided. And I just wanted to sort of remind us near the end of the discussion that this is really, at the end of the day, it's about the suffering of real people and their families. I've been working with a woman named Malika Kasimova since 2010, who's the mother of Ravshan Kasimov, a soldier who spent time on an exchange program in the United States for a few weeks, comes back to Uzbekistan, immediately is accused of being a spy. He was tortured. And, you know, his case is dragged on for a decade. And as I was saying earlier, we've seen the releases of other journalists and human rights defenders, and we've celebrated those successes. But I think some of these cases, they really deserve our attention. That's why I think this program today is so important, because they're not getting out. And, you know, we're talking about Yelena's father getting 12 years, Babur's father getting 6 years. These are long sentences, and they're shrouded in secrecy. The access is denied. And I think that's why this is so important, because if we can examine the facts and we, you know, sort of get demythologized what's happening here, we see pretty quickly that in almost every case, I'm willing to guarantee that there should be an immediate review, if not an immediate release. So I just wanted to bring it back to the names of the victims and their relatives.
Right. No, these are very important points. Steve, thank you for suggesting this as a topic for the discussion on the Majlis podcast. You know, why I was kind of stressing on that point is, like, you know, as a journalist, as we see the way authorities play with the emotions of people. Like, if they are stressed out about something, like, let's say, economy or something else, like any other disaster, they create another headline to kind of divert people's attention. I was just wondering, maybe there is something like that going on in Uzbekistan, so that they created discussions about the spy. Maybe that's not the case here. Even if that is, we have to end the discussion here. So going forward, just very, very quick points. Elena, you have been quiet today. So people who follow these cases and the case of your father, where our eyes should be, I mean, where we should keep our eyes on.
My father is innocent. The case was fabricated, and it's impossible to prove it. We cannot go there. We cannot prove it. We cannot get evidence. It's impossible. In Uzbekistan, it's closed. Trial was closed. Everything is closed. We don't even know where our father is now. So we are helpless. We have no ability to do anything. We just don't know what to do.
Elena, what do you want advocates outside who kind of has a sympathy for your father's case or cases like him? So what you want them to do?
You know, Republic of Uzbekistan call itself democracy. It's not democracy. The way it's going there, it's not democratic way. They are going the way that Soviet Republic was 100 years ago. They need to change. And, you know, any person in Uzbekistan is in danger to be caught and become a spy. They would say, you are a spy because we said so. We don't care what you say. We don't care what your lawyers say. We don't need evidence. It's closed case, closed trial. We are done. You are a spy. So people deserve much better in that beautiful country. And you know, the world human rights organization, they need to do something about it, because it's not normal way of living in 21st century.
Babur, I also wanted your point on that, on the same question. I mean, there are lots of people who are interested in this case outside of Uzbekistan. Is there anything they can do to help?
Well, we are very fortunate, because we're working with some very good human rights organizations, and also some of the Western governments, the United Nations Committee Against Torture, the United Nations Commissioner for Human Rights. If people are interested, then please follow Yelena's and my campaign on Twitter. You can find us there, and we post different things. But what I actually wanted to say is there are less fortunate people whose relatives are in prison, and they're in Uzbekistan, and they don't have the access to to advocacies, the access that we have. Some of the guys who have been mentioned, like Acheldiev, he's been in prison since 2006, and he's a young military commander who studied in Russia and was very ambitious. And, you know, it's the military, and we should be very proud of them. And I would encourage people to not be shy to raise these questions through their governments or even the foreign governments and diplomats who are listening, because the military are the guys who protect our country. And, you know, the fact that they are still there with no rights, people are afraid to get into the politics of it. That shouldn't be right. If you look at some of those historic cases, they're still there, and it's not, nothing's changed for them. And it's been 15 years that some of them are in prison.
Right.
But in our case, we're hoping that our campaign will continue. Of course, won't stop until my father's released.
Right. Last point from you, Steve. It looks like from at least Babur's points that there is interest in his father's case. There are NGOs that he's working with. And what my point was, has there been enough attention by the international community to these cases in Uzbekistan? And what else can be done about this?
Well, I mean, I think this podcast is a great start. I think earlier when Ali Shermoy made the point that perhaps now we're on the cusp of learning how many types of spy mania cases there are actually in prison, that will allow, I think, some organizations and scholars and activists to take it forward and to raise those with the government, to ask for a commission. We're having a lot of discussions now with Uzbek government about the right of former political prisoners to be rehabilitated, to have their cases re-examined. That is quite simply the only way that the narrative of reform in the criminal justice system couldn't be credible or could be seen as credible in Uzbekistan, which is that if you allow human rights organizations on the ground, local ones, not just international ones, to investigate these cases, to raise them, and to have a voice in the process, then you could start to see a change. And so, of course, Kubatin getting rehabilitated was a victory, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. We need to see the government commit to meet with Babur, meet with Yelena, meet with these families. Don't intimidate them, speak with them. And that's the only way I think we're going to be able to get to a different stage. Of course, we want to continue to see the champions of raising democracy and human rights continue to do it and do it publicly. So the U.S. European Commission should make that a permanent feature of their human rights dialogues. Religious prisoners and spy prisoners, if we want to call them that, spy mania cases, are still, I think, at the top of the agenda when we're talking about political prisoners being released in Uzbekistan.
Right. Terrific. Okay. Thank you, Steve Severlu, human rights lawyer specializing in Central Asia, for your time and thoughts today. And also, big thanks goes to Yelena Kuberskaya, daughter of Vladimir Kalushin, who's also in detention, and also Babur Yusupov, son of Hadir Yusupov. He's another detainee in Uzbek jails. And of course, big thanks to Alisher Siddiq, the director of RFRL's Uzbek service, Ozotlik, and Bruce Panier, the editor of Ready for Europe with the Liberty Central Asia blog, Kishlok Owazi. Thank you, colleagues, for joining us today in this important discussion. And this is from me, Mohammed Tahir, Ready for Europe with the Liberty's media manager and host of the Majlis podcast here in Washington, D.C. Until next week, bye-bye.